Hello. Once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 16 of our Disney bracket, the final match of round one. This week, we will be discussing Tangled and Frozen.
We made it this far. Yay! If you're stuck with us, thanks for making it this far with us.
It's very apropos that these are the two films that we're discussing for the last round.
Yeah, we've had some weird-ass mashups. Because our bracket is not modulated for similarity, we've had some really weird things. But these films are incredibly similar since they came out, what, a year after the other?
A little bit more than that. But they have very similar animation styles.
They have a lot of similar plot beats.
Speaking of things on our bracket, we have concluded with our polls on Twitter and Facebook for Zootopia versus The Little Mermaid. It's a little interesting to see what those two platforms and the differences in how they voted, but by about 6 or 7 votes, Little Mermaid is moving on to round two, and Zootopia is relegated. Let's go ahead and get into synopses.
So, with Frozen in the cold north, two princesses are playing. Elsa has ice powers, and on accident, she strikes her sister, Anna, in the head. The parents take them to the trolls, who remove all the magic, even memory of magic. In fear, the parents convince Elsa to hide her powers with her gloves, and then they die. The sisters grow lonely in their isolation from each other. On coronation day, when the gates open, Anna meets and falls hard for Prince Hans of the Southern Isles. But when she tells Elsa of their plans to get married, all the loneliness and fear they've both been failing to deal with properly come to a head, and Elsa lets loose with her powers and runs away, accidentally freezing the fjord and plunging the land into deepest winter. Anna goes after her, leaving Hans in charge. On the way, Anna meets up with a salty ice trader named Kristoff and enlists his help to get up the mountain. When they get there, Elsa is too afraid of hurting anyone and throws them out, accidentally hitting Anna again and freezing her heart this time. Realizing it's killing her, Kristoff takes her to his family, the trolls, who say only an act of true love can save her this time. She goes to find Hans. He's actually back at Elsa's ice palace, where he saves her life when some thugs try to shoot her. She's brought home and imprisoned. Anna gets back and tries to get Hans to kiss her, but he reveals that he was only pretending to love her for her money and as a chance to inherit her throne. Leaving her to die, he tells everyone else that they married just before she passed. He goes to kill Elsa, hoping that will bring back summer. Anna realizes that Kristoff loves her, go with it, and tries to go to him, but on the way she sees Hans about to kill Elsa and intercedes, freezing utterly, and stopping him from killing it. This counts as an act of true love, and Anna thaws out. Elsa realizes that love thaws and brings back summer. Hans is thrown in the slammer, Anna and Kristoff are a thing now, and Elsa uses her powers to bring joy again.
In another kingdom a few years earlier, that doesn't actually go with my opening, so cut that. Long ago, a golden drop of sun fell to earth and grew into a magical flower. For centuries, Mother Gothel kept it to herself, using it to stay young. But after the queen fell sick, the forest was scoured and the flower eventually found. However, when used to cure the queen, it imparted its magical properties to her daughter. Now dependent on the magic to survive, Gothel kidnaps the newborn princess to use her magical hair. The king and queen, hoping their daughter will return, release lanterns each year on the night of her birthday. 18 years later, Rapunzel has decided to leave her tower to investigate the mysterious lights. Gothel forbids it and berates Rapunzel. However, when the thief Flynn Rider climbs the tower to escape Catcher and is knocked unconscious, Rapunzel hatches a plan. She sends Gothel off on a 3-day journey for her birthday present and strong-arms Flynn into escorting her to the lights in exchange for the return of his satchel with the stolen crown. Flynn and Rapunzel begin their journey, but soon find themselves chased by the palace guards and the Stabbington brothers, all enemies Flynn had made earlier. They manage to avoid their pursuers and begin to open up to each other. Rapunzel reveals her magic hair, Flynn reveals his real name is Eugene, and then Gothel appears to plant the seed of doubt in Rapunzel as Eugene collects firewood. The next day, Eugene and Rapunzel enjoy the festival outside the palace, and that evening take a boat out to watch the lanterns, where they both realize that they have fallen in love. The Stabbingtons have caught up to the couple, and Eugene attempts to make peace with them by giving them the crown, but they want Rapunzel. They tie Eugene to a boat with the stolen crown and send him to the palace to be captured. Meanwhile, Gothel is telling Rapunzel, "I told you so," as she points out Eugene sailing away without her. The next morning, Eugene escapes custody, and Rapunzel realizes she's the princess. Eugene goes to rescue Rapunzel, but is shanked by Gothel. Rapunzel agrees to never leave Gothel if she is allowed to heal Eugene, but Eugene cuts her hair as she attempts, destroying the magic, and Gothel fades to dust. Rapunzel's tears have just enough magic to revive Eugene, and they kiss. Rapunzel is then reunited with her parents, and they live happily ever after. Alright, let's go ahead and dive into Frozen first.
Yeah. I kind of yada 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 past a lot of the plot in that one, because there's a lot happening. A part of me appreciates the way it's structured like a Jane Austen novel, with a lot of characters who are falling in love or pretending to fall in love, but with some nefarious goal in mind, and there's people with secrets, and there's like inheritances, and the rich and the poor. It makes it kind of hard to summarize. Like, I left out an entire character.
No one is sad about missing Olaf.
No one is sad. Well, I'm sure someone is, and it's okay to be wrong.
But yeah, the structure of this movie is not necessarily its strong suit. The first third or so of it feel very, very compacted. There's lots of stuff going on, lots of musical numbers that they use to move the plot along.
It feels like an adaptation of a YA book where that was the first few chapters that, you know, there was time to get into, but because the movie had to like snap through a lot of the backstory and not all of it gets enough weight.
And then you have the final third of the film where everything just feels really drawn out and we have a couple superfluous scenes. I don't think we need everything with Hans at Elsa's ice castle. I don't think we need the giant snow monster marshmallow chasing Anna and Kristoff down the mountain.
We don't need the troll song. We do need to have some of the things in it, but we didn't need that song. That said, without it, there's like no song in the second half, so it's kind of weird.
Considering that there's like 3 or 4 songs in the first 15 minutes of the film, I wouldn't necessarily be sad that there wasn't a song until like maybe the very end.
It'd feel uneven, but
the whole film feels uneven already, though.
It does. I really like Frozen Heart, the song that opens the thing, kind of the crowd song of all the ice traders just sawing ice out of the ice, but we really don't need it. None of those characters are particularly prominent apart from Kristoff, who's a kid at the time, and it doesn't really matter that much. We could have taken that away and given that time to Anna and Elsa dealing with their parents' death.
Or move that to the second act where Anna is trying to figure out, how am I going to get up to the mountain? Hey, I can go talk to the ice collectors. They know their way about the mountain because they have to collect ice.
Yeah.
And then you could have put it in there. And that also gives a really good introduction to Kristoff during that song too.
You wouldn't have the thing where he's forcibly adopted by trolls? Maybe that's okay.
I'm pretty sure it's heavily implied that he's an orphan. I feel that were he to have parents, they would not allow him to do such a thing.
I mean, probably. There aren't a lot of great parents in this movie. Anna and Elsa's parents mean well, but the Troll King guy is like, hey,
fear will be your enemy.
They're like, okay, what I got from this is to make Elsa feel really afraid of her powers. Got it. Cool. Perfect. A+ parenting. Let's go die in a hurricane. As a positive thing, the idea that fear is bad and love will help you solve problems and, you know, fix your familial issues, this is a good message. It's just introduced kind of sloppily.
I also think that Anna and Elsa's parents are probably the most antagonistic of parents in all the Disney canon. A lot of what they set up causes the conflict in the film, whereas most other Disney parents are either dead to begin with or are shown to be loving, if just not always in tune with what their kid needs. I think here they're showing that that's a little bit more insidious than other Disney films have shown. Unfortunately, we don't get a whole lot of deep dive into Elsa's relationship with her parents, and especially her father. Part of that is because the entirety of, well, we need to rein in Elsa's powers and help her control them, to the death of her parents, all happens in the middle of Do You Want to Build a Snowman?
Which is a great song. I really appreciate the use of it to show time, how the melody keeps coming back as a leitmotif for their relationship.
But because the song is trying to hold up what is partially the emotional core of this film, and it's not really designed to do that, it kind of falls a little bit.
Yeah, like there's a lot of things in this that could have used like just a little bit more exploration. The time between when Anna conscripts Kristoff for help to get off the mountain to when they get off the mountain is a good chunk of the film. But I just kind of skipped over it in my summary because not a lot of that happens in there is strictly vital. I mean, we have them like falling in love and stuff, which is cool, but it's mostly them kind of wandering. And in another film where there's less happening, that would be fine. You know, we're going to use these conversations to get into Anna as a person or to unpack the issues of royalty and commoner, but they're most just like looking at the pretty scenery, which is very pretty looking, or having the heckin' singing snowman that we don't need.
Yeah, that whole chunk is pretty much filled up with comedy and not a whole lot of character development, because neither Kristoff nor Anna really change during that scene. Anna doesn't change until after she confronts Elsa. Kristoff again, the same. That whole section with them feels much more like siblings teasing each other than people who are romantically interested in one another.
Honestly, if Kristoff had just been like Anna's brother and this was just like a sibling bonding movie with no romantic stuff apart from Hans, that could have been great. So this is, I think, maybe the biggest twist in a Disney movie.
When we're first getting into the meat of the film and they're opening up the palace gates to let everyone in for Elsa's coronation, we're introduced to the Duke of Wesselton.
Open those gates so I may unlock your secrets and exploit your riches.
Did I say that out loud?
And he is blatantly evil and conspiring to use Anna to further his own ends. And it's a very, very obvious setup. And then you have Anna run into Hans, and it's, you know, your typical sort of meet-cute. And it sets up Anna's character as ditzy and awkward and clumsy. And then when we get into Love is an Open Door, if you're paying attention, you can start picking up subtle cues that Hans is not everything that he seems. Specifically, there's this line in the song where Hans is, "With you, I found my place," specifically saying, "Oh, I can use you to inherit this castle because I'm 13th in line in my kingdom and there's no way I'm getting it."
Right. Eventually, Anna goes to him for true love's kiss, and he leans in and he's like,
"Oh, Anna, if only there was someone out there who loved you."
I saw this movie in theaters twice, and the second time, knowing it was coming, I'm just like leaning back, waiting for everyone who doesn't know to just gasp audibly. That sense of palpable betrayal from this, like, the perfect guy up until now is very shocking for a lot of people, especially in a Disney film that doesn't really go there. As an emotional manipulation tactic, it worked, but I'm not sure to what extent I really believe it as a character. You have to do a lot of mental backflips to make sense of every action he takes in the film.
I chalk a lot of it up to he is performing goodness in front of witnesses, specifically to build up himself and to ease the transition when he eventually takes power.
Sure.
Because there's a very stark difference between how Hans acts when there is an audience and how he acts when he is alone with someone he has power over.
Which is pretty common for abusive boyfriends and that kind of thing. That's definitely a thing that happens.
Hans is one of the few examples where I can unironically say that he is virtue signaling. For some small children, this is probably going to be the Luke, I am your father thing that will stick with them forever.
Man, that tracks. Thank you, Disney, for teaching a lot of little kids not to trust men. They're all awful.
One other thing I want to get to before we're gone with Hans is his song with Anna, Love is an Open Door. Just the title, it like kind of pushes you towards understanding how Hans works. Yes, love is an open door. You can easily enter it, but you can also leave whenever you want.
Yeah. It's about access, not about
caring or emotional connections.
Yeah. It does tie really well into Anna's whole thing about having the gates open and being able to connect with people. There are really good themes happening in this film.
And then jumping off of Hans, we also have some of Disney's criticism of themselves again with everyone's reaction to Hans and Anna's engagement.
You can't marry a man you just met.
You got engaged to someone you just met that day?
You mean to tell me you got engaged to someone you just met that day?
Yes, pay attention.
And the best part of that is that half that conversation is happening while they're actively fighting wolves off of the sled.
But I want to help!
No!
Why not?
Because I don't trust your judgment.
Excuse me?
Who marries a man she just met?
It's true love!
Whoa!
If the whole film had been that level of wacky, it would have been great.
Although, to be fair, wacky does give us the most unfortunate character in this film.
God damn it, you're right. Olaf is a snowman that Anna and Elsa make as kids, and then is the vessel into which all of their understandings of love and friendship and family have been poured.
He's kind of their Jiminy Cricket.
As a concept, that's great. They've shifted their internal monologues into external monologues with this character. However, this character is really, really annoying. And he's very inconsistent in how aware he is of his state as a snowman.
You built me. Remember that?
And you're alive?
Yeah, I think so.
That's funny, but there's a lot of that, and it doesn't go away.
There's also just a lot of Olaf that feels very, very artificial. Like, they kind of altered his character in order to fit the comedic side character that the film didn't really have before. Olaf is specifically designed as Anna's quote-unquote animal sidekick.
Basically, yeah.
Insert the line from Moana here.
Mm-hmm. We have so much else happening in this film, and if you remove that character, as I did in my summary, you could probably do a lot of the plot and streamline things or put more effort where it really needs to be.
Yeah, we talk a lot about how not a whole lot happens in between Anna meeting Kristoff and them getting up to the Ice Palace. Most of Olaf's introduction and his song take place during there. That's part of the reason why.
And the stuff before it, when Kristoff and Anna are unpacking Anna's choices in history, that's good character stuff. That could have been fine. It takes a backseat to Olaf stuff.
Yeah, I will readily admit that Olaf in the room as Anna is succumbing to her frozen heart is probably where Olaf is at his best.
Olaf, you're melting.
Some people are worth melting for.
Everything else is very, very hit or miss. There's a few really actually funny jokes that come out of Olaf, but because Olaf is such a drag on the plot in general, I feel bad laughing at them.
And also some of them are jokes that punctuate scenes that didn't really need that tension.
That needed that tension and that was cut because of the comedy.
Yeah. The film's tone is a bit, I don't say grim, but it's generally pretty grounded. Like, this is a fairly high-stakes scenario. The emotional weight for a lot of these characters is pretty heavy. And then Olaf kind of doesn't fit with the tone that we have.
I had the comment when watching Frozen, after we had watched our other film this week, where in comparison, Frozen definitely feels like it takes itself less seriously. And I think that's kind of at the heart of this thing, where the Olaf interjects where he doesn't need to, and the tension and characters' emotions are fine where they're at.
I want to get back into that, but once we're on Tangled.
That's fair. Yeah.
There's a lot of kind of weird world-building stuff, like where Elsa's powers come from. Is she unique in this? How do the trolls fit in? I don't really mind. I'm okay. The narrative causality is at work here, and this is also a fairy tale fantasy film. It doesn't bother me too much. And I actually kind of like how some of the questions make me want to know more. I can imagine more scenarios. I can imagine more in this world. I can imagine that this isn't the first time that something sorcerous has happened in this family line, or that the X gene has presented before, or relations with the trolls have always been kind of a thing for this kingdom.
Speaking of the trolls get a song called Fixer Upper. Everyone's like, Kristoff finally brought a girl home. And the whole song is dumping on Kristoff. He's like, yeah, these are all his flaws, but you should still marry him.
Settle.
There's also just this, well, the only way to fix people is to, like, be romantically involved with them and put in effort. And I think it teaches a really bad lesson to kids. If someone is worth your time, they're going to want to better themselves. It's not your job to improve people.
Often people who are loved by family, friends, romantic partners, community, whatever, can often help them be their best self. But there are other important things like open communication, self-reflection, accountability, that kind of thing that are also important. And it's a bit too simplistic of a concept in a thing that has other aspects of love or lack thereof that are actually well explored.
Elsa was deeply loved by her parents, and look how that all turned out.
That song also has that weird bit where they're like, his thing with the reindeer that's a little outside of nature's laws, that's, I can't read that any other way as implying that there's like something going on between Kristoff and his reindeer, which raises additional questions. And this is a kid's film. What's happening there?
Don't you want your canon bisexual character?
What is this horrible gay monkey's paw that people keep wishing on? Why is it always bestiality? Or Josh Gad? We've kind of ragged on this movie a bit, but a thing I really think is kind of cool is that the act of true love that saves Anna from being frozen is she saves herself by being self-sacrificing, which there's things to unpack about one family member sacrificing too much for their family member who thus far hasn't exhibited any signs of changing. But I still like that it's a family love type thing that fixes the curse. That's kind of cool.
That's probably the strongest point of the film. It's that it's not romantic love that saves the day. It is familial sisterly love. And that's not something that Disney's really dug into. It is somewhat outside of their brand, at least for their animated features. And especially when you get sibling love stories, they tend to be about brothers. Yeah, I give Disney props for that. I also give Disney lots of props for the end scene where Kristoff is thankful for Anna and he's like,
I could kiss you.
I could. I mean, I'd like to. May I? We me? I mean, may we? Wait, what?
Yeah, there's like specifically asking for consent and they kind of like ease their way into it. That's really cool.
And also, like, for all the pacing troubles that this film has, by the end of the film, I do buy the romantic relationship that starts between Anna and Kristoff. I don't feel it's forced or accelerated like a lot of other Disney films.
Right, because they're not getting married at the end. They're just, hey, let's see where this goes. I mean, I assume that they're going to stay canon. I don't expect to have, like, Disney's first big breakup in Frozen 2. But who knows?
We know literally nothing about that film right now.
Except that maybe Elsa gets a girlfriend? Who knows? I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, they're kind of gay-baiting that.
Yeah, which, while we're here, let's unpack the very queer-coded nature of Elsa. If only because you have this metaphor about hiding your true self and then letting it all go in a very icy way that definitely plays into, unintentionally or not, the reveal that Iceman of the X-Men is canonically gay in the comics, and also having, given that Idina Menzel is playing Elsa and she's well known for Rent and Wicked, which are also both very well loved by the gays,
her dress both before and after Let It Go, the fact that she almost never interacts with a male character in the film.
There's a powerful gay energy within Elsa that I appreciate. That said, I know you have a reservation about the queer coding there.
So I'm definitely talking about this as someone outside of the queer community, so everything, giant grain of salt. But it does feel problematic that, whether intentionally or not, Elsa is very queer-coded, but that combined with how the film portrays Elsa as dangerous and out of control.
We're not saying they, like, meant to do that. It's just kind of a unfortunate ramification that when you code any fantasy thing as a real-world oppressed thing, that can often lead to metaphors that break down if you go too far, especially when the fantasy thing is some powerful ability.
I'm not sure how intentional a queer coding of Elsa even was. Maybe the animation staff was intentional, but I doubt it was intentional for the producers and the writers and the directors.
Actually, I can work around this a little bit. See, originally Elsa was going to be the villain. In the fairy tale, this is very loosely based on, the Snow Queen is the villain, and so they're going to have Elsa be this villainous character. And as we know, Disney loves those queer-coded villains. So
that does make a lot of sense.
There is queer coding in her genes, as well as the X gene.
Let's go ahead and jump over to Tangled now.
Yeah. And this also is dealing with family dynamics and how your family members can hurt you, specifically abusive and gaslighting mother figures.
Tangled is unabashedly about abusive parenting. It is the core struggle that Rapunzel has to overcome. And there are so many examples of the abuse that Gothel puts Rapunzel through. Most of these happen during the Mother's Knows Best song or their interactions before or after that. But there are backhanded compliments and, I'm just teasing, don't take everything so seriously. Her talking over Rapunzel, refusing to listen. There's always this sense that Gothel's needs are met first before Rapunzel's. I'll talk to you after we do the song and I get my youth back. There's also the fact that very often Gothel is embracing or praising Rapunzel's hair as opposed to her personally. There's this line, trust me, pet, that very clearly moves the dynamic away from mother-daughter.
And a lot of the way she talks about the outside world being dangerous is very infantilizing.
Mm-hmm. Rapunzel attempts to embrace Mother Gothel, but you zoom out and it's just Gothel's cloak on this mannequin. It gives you the sense that Gothel is not there to help Rapunzel emotionally. Rapunzel,
you think I'm not strong enough to handle myself out there?
And Gothel responds,
oh, darling, I know you're not strong enough to handle yourself out there.
Every opportunity she has to tear down Rapunzel to make sure that Gothel maintains complete control and that Rapunzel feels she can't survive without her is important.
After the whole adventure happens, they come back to the tower and it's kind of the all is lost moment. Gothel says,
there, it never happened.
Not, it's like it never happened, or let's pretend it never happened. She just says, it never happened, which is a very gaslighting way of making her question her own memory. I will say that while I think it's important to unpack, I think it's a very big lesson for Disney to tackle. I think they do a pretty good job with it. There are times when it's a little bit too heavy-handed. I think they could have dialed things back a little bit. In the first conversation they have, almost everything is a backhanded compliment, and then, oh, I'm just kidding, a backhanded compliment, oh, don't worry, I love you. And it's a little bit, I get it. Then again, it also is for kids, so making it very clear and obvious is good. Not all instances of abuse and gaslighting are that obvious, and they might have been able to strike a slightly more subtle balance and still have it be very clear for kids. I'm not quite sure where that line would be.
Yeah, neither of us have any sort of training in child psychology and what they'd be able to pick up. But I don't disagree that how obvious everything is can impede someone's ability to pick up on more subtle emotional abuse in a relationship like that.
But, I mean, then again, who can say what anybody really needs at the time? I'm sure this has helped a lot of people. Like, I know that I've seen posts on, like, Tumblr and Twitter talking about how people have realized the abuse they were suffering or had been suffering after seeing this movie, which is really impressive. So, hats off. To lighten things a bit, I like how we can't quite tell how witchy Gothel is. Like, she has the hair thing, but that's mostly just her knowing the one song to make it work. She'll pull off a vanishing act, but it's unclear if she's teleporting or if she just knows a bit of stage magicianship.
And how much of it is just, this is a song and dance number, and so reality is a little fuzzy.
Right. I like that. I think it's cool that we have a, kind of like, what's her bucket? Mother Tremaine, how she's just as terrifying as Maleficent or Ursula without having any real power beyond just manipulation.
Also, it's very interesting to see her visual evolution throughout the film as she goes longer and longer without having her youth restored by the hair. And you see more gray, you see more wrinkles. It's almost like you're more and more seeing Gothel's true self as opposed to the facade that she puts on.
So, Gothel's kind of a heavy topic. Let's jump over to a slightly happier bit. Maximus, the best horse in the Disney canon.
Yes, without a doubt, any other Disney horse you put up against Maximus will lose.
Mm-hmm. Maximus is very obviously a paladin. There's a wonderful bit where Flynn throws Maximus a sack of apples and says,
"What? I bought them."
Maximus starts eating a few and says,
"Most of them."
And Maximus's like brain cannot process what's happening. And I don't know who on the writing staff was like, "Okay guys, what if Javert, but a horse? They are the unsung hero of many childhoods."
And you also have Pascal, who is Rapunzel's animal companion for the film, who is also really great and for the most part just acts as Rapunzel's hype man.
Again, externalization of internal stuff.
And I think, especially contrasting Maximus and Pascal with Olaf and Sven from Frozen, I think Tangled does a much better job of balancing the weight of their story with their comedic timing.
We get a lot of good jokes of Maximus because he's a horse that acts like a dog and also like Inspector Javert, but they're a lot faster because he doesn't have dialogue, so it doesn't stop the plot. And often like he'll be doing things that will actively interact with the plot, like when he having a sword fight with Flynn, just holding a knife in his mouth, and Flynn shouts,
"You should know that this is the strangest thing I've ever done!"
And I think that's part of the problem. Whereas most of the verbal humor in Frozen relies on Olaf, this joke character, most of the verbal humor in Frozen comes from Eugene. Because of the character that Eugene is, all of his jokes are really snappy and off the cuff, and you don't have to linger on it for humor. It's just, oh, that's funny, and then we can move on. Like, the dialogue is so snappy. It almost reminds me of Ghostbusters with how fine-tuned all the jokes are.
I'm also gonna say Princess Bride.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's get into Eugene Flynn a little bit here.
Okay.
Because some of the stuff with him is one of my bigger complaints about the film. I like the character. He's really great. He's very much like this generation's Aladdin. He's, you know, really funny. Rapunzel is like 17, 18, and I don't know how old he is. I'm not sure if it ever directly says. He reads to me like he's in his 20s. He reads as being just older enough that I feel a little bit weird with the relationship. It's not too bad. It's not like John Smith and Pocahontas level, but it's just enough that I'm like, there's a hint of squickiness there, especially because Rapunzel's very sheltered and he's very worldly. And he does seem pretty young because like he definitely like has facades of coolness as opposed to actual coolness, so we're not really sure where that is. But because of how he acts more like a man than a teenager and his voice is low enough to be man-esque, I'm wary. It's a yellow flag. Not a red flag, just a yellow flag.
I get where you're coming from, but there's specifically this point after they escape the cave that is slowly being filled with water. There's this point where Eugene makes a conscious decision to pull away from Rapunzel because he realizes how attached he's getting. And I'm not sure whether that is him just kind of refusing to open up because of his difficult childhood, him not wanting to get rid of this facade that gives him confidence and allows him to be the person that he wants to be as opposed to this poor orphan nobody, or whether he realizes how naive Rapunzel is and he is wary of taking advantage of her. I think both reads are valid, and that is the reason why I am not as concerned with the possible age difference between them.
It's kind of like the stuff with Mother Gothel, where I feel like they could have like tweaked that dial a little bit, maybe just like remove the stubble or something. And
but I love the stubble. I love
it's a very good look.
A, it's a very good look, and B, I also like, Eugene is the first Disney prince that actually has facial hair. I like that they are, while not lots, adjusting the spectrum of what Disney Prince Handsome is.
Original concept art for Eugene / Flynn had him be like much like fatter. He was more bear-esque as opposed to like this like very like svelte twinkish guy, and I'm kind of sad we didn't get that like tubby Disney prince. That could have been nice.
I would really like them, but the direction they went for Flynn, I'm not quite sure it worked because of like how his character functions and acts as this dashing, swashbuckling rogue. It doesn't necessarily tie into that physique very well. That's another conversation about how valid that is, but
right.
Disney plays to tropes. That's what they've always done.
Yeah. Let's talk about the bandits and the ugly duckling.
The snuggly duckling.
The snuggly duckling. That's what I said. I can edit it, so you'll never know. Let's talk about the bandits and the snuggly duckling.
I really like the addition of the bandits. Again, it kind of ties into redemption, which is a thing Disney loves to slip into its movies. It also ties into the kind of second tier lesson of this movie about dreams and working towards them. You know, you may have wandered off of the path towards your goals, but there's never a point where you can't get back on.
I think the characters work really well. The, I guess, pacing and editing of how all that happens is a little rushed to me.
That's fair.
So when they get to the bar, they recognize Eugene from his wanted posters and they're like, hey, let's turn him in. We all need money for various reasons. And then they have a song and now they're entirely on his side and even willing to like rescue him later on in the film. It goes a little fast and like a few more lines of dialogue could have fixed that because I don't quite buy that they're that okay with letting this prize slip through their fingers.
Especially since there's the action sequence in the quarry that's right after this that probably goes on a little bit too long and could have been cut for time.
Right. That said, the weirdness of how some of their dreams are being a concert pianist, being a mime, they add to this weird atemporal thing that the movie has that I appreciate.
All right, I want to dig into Rapunzel.
Oh, for sure.
Rapunzel is a great character. The fact that she has been trapped alone in a tower with only a chameleon and her abusive mother to converse with for 18 years, and the way they convey that in her character is spot on. Especially immediately after she leaves and she's kind of wishy-washy between, this is great, oh god, what have I done, this is great.
Yeah, I think she's up there with Megara for being the most well-characterized Disney princesses. Yeah.
It even comes across in all of Rapunzel's songs. Every single one of them reminds me of like early Taylor Swift. It's just a girl alone in a room with a guitar. It builds so much into her character. There's also the fact that Rapunzel is incredibly proactive. We see this with how she tries to fill her time in the tower while she's alone, effectively, with the exception of Pascal. We also see it with how many times she has to save Eugene as opposed to the more worldly rogue having to save her. We don't get Flynn repaying the favor until the very end of the film, and even then he ends up getting stabbed and Rapunzel has to save him again.
This is one of my favorite parts of the narrative of abuse in this. The jig is up. Everybody like knows that Gothel only wants Rapunzel for her hair, and she says,
I won't stop for every minute of the rest of my life. I will fight. I will never stop trying to get away from you. But if you let me save him, I will go with you.
And I conceptually love the idea that she acknowledges her situation as being inescapable and decides to own it and make it so that she still has some victory. So somehow this is at least partially her choice. Owning your abuse is a big part of dealing with it emotionally, and I like that they give that to her. That's a really good thing. There's a running thing where, because Rapunzel's afraid to speak up, she will mumble a little bit, and then Mother Gothel will, you know, say,
Rapunzel, please stop with the mumbling. You know how I feel about the mumming.
And then at the end, Rapunzel says, hey, no, I am never singing for you again. And Gothel's like, what? And then she's like,
did I mumble, Mother?
Which is, it's so good. That's, like, that is an amazing line. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they built the whole film around that, but I kind of hope they did.
So we're going to talk about animation here. Both of these films have basically the same style. Instead of talking about one film as opposed to the other, we're kind of going to be going back and forth on them. Tangled is a much prettier movie. I don't think anyone would necessarily disagree with that. And partially that's due to the constraints of the plot of Frozen. Because everything's covered in ice and snow for most of the film, they don't have a very wide palette to work with.
You do have some variance when you have light coming through Elsa's ice palace, and you have a lot of really gorgeous colors and cool variations on the colors, and the way that the ice works like glass, it means you get some really cool visuals. In general, there's not a lot of light happening directly on the characters. The light's ambient and atmospheric because there's all these clouds, or it's happening at night, so you don't have this beautiful bloom effect that Tangled does. Whereas with Tangled, because you have sunlight as a motif and as a part of the character's backstory and all that jazz, you have all these beautiful dynamic lightings and skin feels very vibrant.
And then you have lights of the lanterns at night. There's also this sickly green lantern that Mother Gothel uses and then also lends to the Stavington brothers to signal Flynn that they found him while they're on the water. There's just a lot more variety going on in Tangled, and that's what makes it stronger. I don't think there's any drastic differences in the modeling of characters.
And I'll give Frozen this. I mentioned the ice being transparent, but you also have a lot of really cool fractalization effects. But unfortunately, they look cool, but they only happen with Elsa and her powers, so a lot of the film doesn't have that happening. You mentioned before that Tangled takes itself more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of disagree. I feel like Frozen takes itself more seriously, but then has jokes in it, whereas Tangled is taking itself a bit less seriously because you have this whole, like, horse Javert. You have frying pans as a go-to weapon. You have the guy whose whole thing is ceramic unicorns. Characters called the Stabbington brothers. Tangled is having more fun, and because it's allowing itself to have fun and take some of itself a little less seriously, it's more coherent with its tone of being less serious.
I can see where you're coming from. I think more so where I'm coming from is that Tangled knows when its core message needs to be taken seriously, and it knows that sometimes it's not the time for a joke. And I don't always feel that Frozen has that same sort of wisdom.
Yeah, I get you on that.
And I think that's mainly where my problem is coming from. Like, yes, overall, Tangled is much more silly than Frozen is. But I think that Tangled does a much better job of managing when it's serious and when it's comedic, whereas Frozen is a little all over the place.
So yeah, I think, as you've probably already guessed, what's moving on is Tangled.
Both of these films are really good. And if your main draw to Disney is the music, then yeah, Frozen probably wins in that regard. But overall, how well the film all works together, Tangled definitely pulls ahead.
It's not that Frozen isn't a good film. Like, I think if you had to make a choice between, like, Frozen, Chicken Little, Frozen would move ahead. But just the way the bracket crumbles, here we are.
Yeah. We literally joked about, it doesn't really matter what wins episode 15, because whatever wins episode 16 is going to eat it alive.
This is the last episode of this round. Now we're moving back into round two, so we're going to be comparing films we've already talked about. We might go a little lighter on the summaries from here on.
What will probably end up happening is our summaries will turn into a summary of points from the last episode we talked about these films. So, next week, you will be listening to us talk about Bolt and Moana once again.
Ooh, that's going to be fun.
Once again, this has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. Thank you for listening. Remember to like, share, and subscribe.